Welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese, CPG advisor and now founder of It's All Happening, an agency that helps brands with launch strategy. Tune in as we break down ways that successful female entrepreneurs are using to build their businesses. You'll hear stories of the people who make shit happen, overcoming struggles and celebrating the wins. We cover how brands are taking products to market, tactics that work, things that have failed, and just lessons learned from out in the field. Whether you're looking for inspiration, industry secrets, or launching a brand, this is the place. Okay, you guys, today's episode is with Sarah Delavan of The Good Food CFO. And I have to say that I am just such a fan of Sarah and her business. If you haven't checked out her podcast, I talk about it a million times in this show. It's so good. The Good Food CFO, you can find it where you get all your podcasts. She is just such an amazing resource for food and beverage CPG brands or just food and beverage brands in general. Sarah is a financial consultant with over 15 years experience in building and supporting sustainable and regional food systems. So she's the founder of The Good Food CFO, which is an educational platform. She also does one-on-one consulting, and she works with purpose-driven food businesses from farmers, ranchers, fishers, producers to help them achieve profitability by design. So her career has spanned nearly every corner of the good food movement. So from teaching kids to cook with seasonal ingredients, she's been a volunteer at No Kid Hungry and farmers markets. She launched a pop-up grocery that she'll talk about a little bit in this episode. She has also managed food sourcing for a major LA-based catering company. Her hands-on experience really just informs her values-driven financial approach. And I love how she speaks in a very simplified, sort of like pared down way about finance and costs and margins and what it actually takes to build a profitable food business. So I love this conversation with Sarah. Today we're talking about debt tolerance and, you know, what it really takes to get your business off the ground and how to build a business on your own terms, which is something that she loves to talk about. So Sarah is just a wealth of knowledge. I can't wait to share this with you guys, and I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So without further ado, let's dive in with Sarah. Sarah Delavan, welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Danielle. I'm so excited to be here.
We're going to have a fun conversation about risk and debt tolerance, which I feel like is such a hot topic with founders. But before we get going, I just wanted to introduce you. You have such an amazing educational platform called The Good Food CFO. You have so much to offer, honestly. And if you guys haven't heard of Sarah and The Good Food CFO, you really should check out her podcast. It's like one of my favorites. I never miss an episode. I love it so much, really. It's so educational and it's just really simple and straightforward, which I feel like finance gets a bad rap because it can be so complex and overwhelming. And I feel like you really break it down in a way that's just digestible. So thank you for your awesome podcast. But Sarah also does consulting. You have a membership, coaching and advising. So yay, I'm so excited to chat with you.
Thank you. Yeah. And thank you for calling out the sort of simplification of finance. It's something that is like a pillar of what we do. And part of our mission is to take this complex topic and to make it easy to understand, but beyond that, like easy to execute within your business. So
yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, you and I have like very similar business models, right? Like we offer different services, but we essentially have a very similar business. We offer educational content and like one-on-one consulting services and also much more affordable type products like courses and classes and downloadable stuff. And I feel like simplifying this like very complex topic is so important. And it's like you know, redefining. I've been kind of using this term a lot more, and I feel like you totally fall under this. It's like redefining how businesses are built, essentially, because if you can simplify it, it just, it helps you understand it more so you can really just make better decisions, because that's what it's all about, right? And that's what my goal is. And I know that's what yours is as well.
Yeah, we have something called a Baba Yacht. That's what we call our members, like the folks in our membership. And it stands for building a business on your own terms. And really where that comes from is this idea of helping founders understand what is possible, like what their options are. And I think that, and then giving them the opportunity to choose how they want to build their business, right? And we're going to talk, I think, a lot about that today, as you said, like around debt and risk tolerance. But yeah, it's like if folks like us aren't doing it, it's so easy for founders to fall into the this is the way it's always been done. There's one path up for growth for CPG, right? And it's just not true. And so I'm really glad to be in collaboration with you and so many other women, you know, within the CPG industry, talking about the options and the different ways that folks can do things.
It's important to know your options. So, okay, first question though, before we dive into like all the business and finance stuff, what are you currently hustling for?
I'm personally, the hustle word is, you know, I'm working very hard toward a brand reset. So we're doing a big rebrand for the Good Food CFO, which is like super exciting. And we're actually working to launch software. So I don't know when this episode is coming out.
September.
So this might be September. Okay. So it's, so it might be available at the time that this episode comes out. It's something that has been like in my mind for gosh, the last like 10 years. And I've started and stopped with it, And just recently I was like, we have to do it. Like it has to be done. The time is now. And so we're actively working on that. And it's ridiculously exciting.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool. I can't even imagine what possibly goes into a software launch.
Like, I'm learning as I go. Right?
That's crazy. Wow. Interesting. Yeah. Having this type of business, like consulting services business, is a very different business from the business that, that I know very well, which is food and beverage CPG, right? Packaged food. So I've had to learn this whole different type of business, but like software is also an additional, completely
different
separate
animal.
Business. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting. Well, I'm excited for that to come out. What
Thank
is the
you.
Software going to entail and what is it? What does it support?
That's a great question. So long story short, you know, we have downloadable tools that have created a really big impact for founders in their business, helping them to develop their financial strategies. But number one, Excel-based tools are scary to a lot of people. They're easy. Like, we do our best to simplify them, make them like unbreakable. But there's also like limitations to that. So it's difficult to make them talk to one another, or if someone buys one tool and then later buys another tool, they're not inherently connected. And I have felt for a long time that our tools are really powerful. They're very impactful. They're very simple, but I want them to be connected so that founders, A, don't have to deal with Excel-based tools, and B, like we further simplify the process of creating a profitable food business and creating a financial strategy that aligns with what we're talking about today, folks like debt and risk tolerance, they get to build the businesses that they want. So it's sort of like more of the same of what we've been doing, but much more powerful, much more simplified, and like a really nice, you know, online platform to do it in.
So getting into this topic about, you know, debt tolerance and just risk tolerance in general, why is it that founders feel like they need to raise? Like, what's up with that? Why do founders always feel like, especially first-time founders or early-stage founders, feel like they need to raise or take on debt early on?
Yeah, I think there's a couple reasons. Number one is that, and I say this a lot now, every business starts in debt.
Yeah.
Right? When you open your business bank account, there's no money magically in there. Your business automatically goes in debt either to you as the founder who's investing money, to family and friends who might be investing money, to the credit card company that might be, you know what I mean? You might be using to purchase things, you know, to the bank. you know, or the SBA loan that you've gotten. So from day one, you are borrowing money as a business to get things going. So that's one reason, right? It's like legitimately you do need money to get things going.
Of course.
Number two is it's what we see in media, right? It's a win if you go on Shark Tank and you get a deal.
Yeah.
It's a win if you, you know, have a big raise, right? That is what is celebrated in media, regardless of the fact, you know, or I should say, regardless of whether or not you can turn that raise into a profitable business, regardless of how long your business can stay in business after doing that raise, what's celebrated is the raise itself.
Yeah.
So I think people, A, want to grasp onto that shiny object and, you know, and be celebrated and have that win. And then the third thing I think is that there is a quote unquote way that folks believe a CPG business has to be built, and that is fast and it's nationwide and it's, you know, with the goal of having an exit on the other end, right? And for that path, you will need to raise money, right? You will need to fundraise because it is so extremely expensive to do it. And, you know, I hear people say all of the time, I don't make any money in CPG. The margins are so tight. So I'm going to make my money when I sell.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be that way. You know, if you come and listen to the Good Food CFO podcast, you visit the website, like I'm big into building regional brands that are wildly profitable for a number of reasons, you know, local brands, regional brands, and breaking through this idea of there's only one way to build and that you need to do like a formal raise or a big raise to be successful. But I think those are the three primary reasons.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And also because of the fundraising climate and interest rates and how expensive it can be and the difficulty of raising, I think it's forced us back into, you know, to take a step back into that like more regional mindset.
Yeah.
And it's really something that I have been like really pushing with my clients over this past year is focusing on a more local, regionalized, profitable approach. Because the truth of the matter is there's not a lot of people out there that really are comfortable or even know how or have any type of expertise on how to go and raise a ton of money and then what to do with it. Not saying that they can't learn, of course, you know, and maybe over time you change your strategy once you've been in market for so long. But when you're first getting your sea legs in CPG and like you're trying to really prove yourself out, I just love the regional approach because it's just so much more manageable. And if designed right, can be profitable, which is like sort of this thing that people are like, oh, okay, you know?
Yeah. Can I share a story really quickly?
Please.
There was a period of time where I think it was like a 3-week time frame where every person who came for an initial consultation for my fractional CFO consulting business, they all were coming to me because they had gotten investment from someone from like insert big CPG brands, like General Mills, right? Like just the list goes on. They had gotten investment from them. And because they didn't know on their own, like, how do you build this national CPG brand? The investor had taken the lead. Mm-hmm. And if you have someone on your team, from what I have seen, who, let's say, has worked for General Mills, they're building your small business like it's General Mills. And in every one of those instances, over, I think it was like 10 people in like a 3-week time frame, they were like, they ran my business into the ground. I have run out of money. We have burned through all of the investment that they made. And in a couple of instances, those folks wanted to exit and it was like they wanted to be paid out. Mm-hmm. So there were so many women in particular with these amazing products, these amazing brands who were like, you know, in this position of, I took the investment, I followed their lead, and I'm in a worse place now than I was before, right? Yeah. And so everything that has happened both in my career and then two, you know, CPG founders along the way has informed what I communicate today, how I like approach, you know, financial strategy and stuff. It's like, I don't want people to be in a position like those folks were like ever again. You know what I mean? And also I think to echo what you're saying, like if you start regional and you really focus on that and you get your sea legs there, there's such a great opportunity to know your customer.
Yeah.
Right. And to like really deliver and drive velocity. And there's so much value and benefit to that in addition to profitability.
I've seen, you know, a lot of people describing the same situation that you have. I've also been through it myself too, as well as a founder. And I've never really like, I haven't really spoken like on the podcast or anything about this, but I had a company and there was investment made. And it was the wrong type of investment to get us going. And it ultimately ended up in me having to exit the company because I owned nothing. You know, I owned nothing of the company. And it happened so quickly. I felt so blindsided by how quickly it happened. The amount of the company that I ended up owning as a founder was so slim that it just didn't make sense. I was just like, there's just no way. Like, I'm just going to go get a job. This is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And it was devastating for me because I had built so much IP that I had invested in and myself.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was saying about the educational piece around this, I think is so important for founders because a wrong move with the type of money that you take in can end up in dissolving the company. Wow. Essentially.
Yeah.
So
thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. I feel like I should do an episode about that specifically, about my former company and like all the wrong mistakes that I made around the investment piece, because
it'd be wildly helpful.
Probably would be helpful for some folks. So,
yeah.
So Sarah, you use the term debt tolerance often. So can you just unpack like what that truly means for someone who maybe isn't familiar? What does debt tolerance mean?
I don't know the formal definition, but how I define it is like literally, literally a person's comfort level with taking on debt. So I like to talk about, you know, this one founder that I work with who has just an immense tolerance. They have zero fear for taking on debt. You know, they'll figure out how to pay for it in the future. They are not concerned, you know, millions of dollars of debt on the balance sheet. And they're just comfortable with it. So they have a very high debt tolerance. I've worked with other founders who, when they've got 50K on the balance sheet in debt, they have a hard time sleeping at night. If their cash runway isn't meaning that, you know, how many weeks that the cash in their bank will last is not long enough, they're very tense and they're just uncomfortable. They have a very low debt tolerance. Mm-hmm. And again, like through my work and working with so many different founders and seeing how different people are in relation to debt and how stressful it can be for so many people, I started to talk about debt tolerance. And I started to say, like, listen, if you aren't comfortable taking on more debt in order to achieve this growth path that you have laid out for you, we can create a different path. Because there's no sense in going down that road if you're not going to be able to sleep, if you're going to be unhappy, if you're going to be stressed out all the time, right? And so we call that right sizing, essentially saying like, sometimes it just takes a gut check and a founder being honest and going, you know what? I'm not cozy with taking on more debt. I'm not comfortable with where my cash runway is right now. What is another strategy that we can look at that will make me feel more comfortable and create a more cash abundant and profitable business that doesn't need more debt?
Yeah.
So when you find that a founder has a very low tolerance for debt tolerance.
Yeah.
What are some of the things that you recommend like right away?
Well, one of the things that's like a core teaching of ours is that your product margins have a direct impact on your cash flow and your reliance on debt, like today or in the future, right? And so number one, we want to look at the products that this founder is selling or wants to sell. And we want to understand their margins in every channel that they're currently selling in or that they're thinking about selling in. So on the podcast, we talk a lot about, you know, a 50% margin is just enough to make one more unit of product. You're not contributing any revenue from the sale of a 50% margin product to operating costs or any other part of your business. Yep. So at 50%, you're going to, at some point in the future, need more money put into the business to help cover the operating expenses and or to help grow your production.
Yep.
The higher above 50% product margin you get, the less debt you're going to need. And it's like incremental. And of course, it depends on your business. It depends on lots of things. But just in general, right, that's like kind of a rule of thumb. Yeah. And so we're looking at those things. And that's like where we start with all of our financial strategy. And then once you understand, okay, here's our baseline product margin and here's what they look like in each channel, then that provides some direction in terms of like, where do we want to sell and what kind of business do we want to build?
Right.
Some folks have more comfort with like taking on debt and investing it in marketing as opposed to taking on debt and putting it toward distributor fees and trade spend and things like that, right?
Right.
And so we take all of that into consideration and build a business that will as closely align to their debt tolerance as we possibly can.
85% of CPG brands never make it, yet you still crave your product on shelf. I get it. I'm Danielle, former operator. I've done 30 plus launches. I'm a two-time founder and the force behind a multi-million dollar CPG portfolio. Join my live power hour and we're going to break down how to launch a brand that really wins. I will go over the four mission critical phases that you must go through in order to build that solid foundation for your CPG brand. I'm also going to touch on my top 10 mistakes that I see founders make that really hold them back. So spots are limited, save your seat. And in the show notes, we'll have a link for you to sign up.
So sometimes I start working with founders and I ask them questions like, where do you see yourself in 5 years? Or where do you see the business in 10 years? And sometimes the founders don't know. Mm-hmm. How do you coach people into, number one, figuring that out? I really do feel like a lot of founders don't know.
Yeah.
Where they want to be in 5 or 10 years, number one. And then reverse engineering the business model based on that, or pivoting, right? Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes when you start to think about those things, you realize that your current operational situation doesn't support what you're actually trying to move towards.
Yep.
So how do you coach founders in that? Like, what are some of the questions you ask them?
I will ask if they have a certain feeling around debt. Do you know what I mean? I will, if they say like, I'm not sure what I want to build. Okay. We'll try to assess their debt tolerance and their risk tolerance. Oftentimes they're not really clear on that either because they don't have a concept of like how much money something like building a business of a certain kind will take.
Yeah.
So really what we do then is we take their products and we put them in our what we call as a perfect pricing calculator. Yep. I should rename it because it really is all about margin. But what it does is it allows us to say, to see every product and their margins in every channel. And I tell people all of the time, do this exercise for every channel you could possibly sell in.
Yeah.
Because if you think you want to go into distribution, or you don't know if you want to go into distribution, but you have a product and you know the cost, you know your retail price, we're going to very quickly see.
Yeah, you can do it. Yeah. Yeah.
What that margin is going to be. And I have a great presentation. I did it inside the your cohort, your masterclass cohort.
I'm at Launch Lab. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. And it showed how someone went from a 54% margin in D2C to a 7% margin in distribution. And that was like before trade spend and stuff, right? That was a real business example.
Yeah.
And when people start to see that, they sometimes go, oh, okay. How can we change that? Or how do we improve that? You know what I mean? And then I can start to sense like, okay, they want to go in a certain direction and they want to figure out how, or they'll just be like, I don't want anything to do with that. So I'll be able to start to get a sense of kind of what they want to build.
Yeah.
If I can't sort it out there, we just do a bigger projection, and it's a really high level projection, but it shows how much money it would take to grow within a certain channel. And we can calculate and make some debt assumptions. And then that usually gets folks like very clear on if they're cozy doing it, or if they're like, you know what? No, I want to have a smaller business that requires less debt and I can create a path to profitability.
That's why I like working with super early stage founders. I love working with people before they've launched.
Yeah.
I like doing exercises like that because so oftentimes we find
that the cost of goods is needs work, or the channel strategy or the pricing needs work before we take it to market, because of the reasons you're outlining right now, right?
Yeah.
The profitability isn't going to support the cash flow and the ability to access funds.
Yep.
So you usually have to make some changes and tweaks, but what happens if you're already out in the market and you haven't fully done that exercise and you realize, oh shit, I have to make some changes, but my product's already on shelf. Much harder, right? Much more difficult situation. That's why I love to partner with founders early on.
Yeah.
So we can like map it out properly, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So going back to when you start working with a founder, what is the smartest way for a founder to like really determine how much capital they need? So obviously, like I'm sure you guys build out models all day, but what are some of the things that you're looking at to assess these things?
Yeah, we're looking at a lot of what we've already talked about today. Yeah. So like, what are the product margins?
Yeah.
In D2C, in wholesale direct, in distribution, right? If someone has a vision for the kind of business that they want to build, we can actually build a very simple model. I don't believe in really complex models for early stage brands because
I completely agree. I looked at one the other day and the brand hasn't even launched. And it was, I was just like, oh my God, this is actually insane.
I was like, this is too much for even me to take in. I saw one recently, 20 tabs.
Yeah.
That's summary tab, like too. All these things. And I was like, this is so much to take in. And the founder was like, yeah, I don't have a strategy. I just have this like model. And I'm like, well, let's get you a strategy, right? And so it's like, start with your product margins. Look at them in the core channels that you believe you want to grow into. And then a lot of times what we'll do is we'll say, okay, let's just start at, you know, even revenue distribution across three channels, let's say, or two channels. Right? Start simple. And the projected operating costs, like you're going to have to do some projecting or forecasting, as they call it. It's not going to be 100% accurate.
Of course not.
It never will. But you can't even predict what's going to happen next week, let alone, you know, a year to 5 years in the future.
No.
But you can pull together some concrete information to create a really simple, like I'm talking 5 to 6 line forecast.
Yep.
Where you can say, okay, this is how many units we're selling over time, or this is how much revenue we're generating over time, which is the way I think is easiest for founders to do it.
Yeah.
So let's say every 6 months we're going to increase our sales, right? Based on that trajectory, we're going to require this much debt, and we're going to, right? And we're going to have to get our sales up to, and I'm making up numbers, $100,000 in revenue. With our operating costs, you know, at X thousand dollars per month, we'll have $125,000 in debt, you know, from starting the business. And then at that point in time, things start to change where we're generating enough money where we don't need any more debt and we're able to start paying things off, right? So we can see like how long do we need to grow for? What point do we need to grow where our financial situation starts to change and we become cash flow positive, right? Because you're not going to typically be cash flow positive from day one.
No.
There's going to need to be investments, right, to keep your production growing to get there. And then oftentimes what really surprises people is that you can see like, oh, if I just hold steady at this point, I actually can make a bunch of money.
Yep.
Right? And then that starts to shift their gears and go, okay, I like the sounds of making that much money. I like how the effect of that on my debt balance. I like the effect of that on my, like, bank account. And some people will say, let's grow to that. Like, that's my like number one vision. And then we'll start bringing in the money and then we'll grow from there. But I think I'm getting away from your question, but it's a simple forecast.
Yeah.
Because you can project and predict how much cash will be needed. And then the cool thing with the forecast is that you can update it in real time. And if it's a really simple forecast, it's very simple to update.
Yeah.
Here were my actual operating expenses. Here was how much I actually brought in. And then you'll see how does that change the rest of this projection.
No, I agree. Keeping it simple at the beginning and not having those like crazy complex models. Though I will say when you get into like D2C and paid media, it does get complicated. Like, I feel like a retail model can almost be a little bit more straightforward because the more complex ones I've seen are the ones that are heavily focused in D2C and they have different channels, right? They've got like Amazon, TikTok Shop and Shopify. And then we're trying to factor in customer acquisition costs and lifetime value. And like, that's when it, it does get complicated. Yeah. What about simplifying that sort of?
I actually have been privy to like a really great company that I actually don't know the name of, but the gentleman's name is Jamie. And just last week, he was showing me his reports. And it was number one, I often find it difficult to get reporting from marketing people.
Right.
They specifically are like running ads and trying to drive sales and they're doing it with a very specific budget. And his models I thought were great. And they're really focused on like what are we trying to achieve. And so he's modeling out, okay, here, how are we performing for a while, right? So very like research-based, like how are things actually going? And then flipping it to, okay, how do we recreate this, right? And how do we replicate this and finding the sweet spot of spending? His models, I don't want to say that they're not complex because there's so many data points, but they're so clear that I can then take that model and put it into my simplified financial model. And to me, having that a bit separated, the way my brain works, makes the most sense.
This is a brand or a service provider you're talking about?
I'm talking about a service provider.
Service provider.
They do online ads and marketing for one of my clients. Yes, it is complex. Because it's like, you want to understand like how much are we spending to acquire a new customer and then what is the average lifetime value of that? Like it is very, very complex. And I have been asked to project that in the past and I say no. Because I don't know enough about it. It's literally not really to me a financial model. It is a marketing
It's a different
model. It's very different.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It's a different. It's just an expertise, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's where I've seen them get really complicated is with the e-com channels.
Yeah.
And the CAC and the LTV and stuff. So,
yeah.
I know. I feel like the retail ones are just like so much more straightforward. And anyway, and these are important things to look at too. You do need to know like how much does it cost you to acquire a customer? And when you actually acquire them, how long do you need to hold on to them until it pays itself back?
Yeah.
Here's a little message from Allie Ball, the founder of Food Biz Wiz and creator of Retail Ready.
Wholesale Week runs from September 8th to the 12th, and it's 5 days of bite-sized lessons on how to increase sales in your wholesale account. So how do we talk to grocery buyers? How do we create sales strategies that get repeat orders? How do we figure out how we're actually going to grow for the rest of 2025. So it's free, it's 10 minutes a day, and it's all done online. You can find it at foodbizwiz.com/wholesaleweek or directly in the episode show notes.
So how would you say that founders can balance the need for growth with the reality of limited cash flow? So I've seen early stage brands that take investment early on, and there's a lot of pressure to perform because they have investors, whether those investors are angel friends and family or more professional like VCs. You know, when you have investors on your cap table, like I feel like regardless of who they are, you feel a lot of pressure to perform. And that top line revenue like really becomes a topic. But how do you recommend that people sort of like balance that and don't just automatically feel like they have to reach for more money?
Yeah. That's a really great question. And I think it depends a bit on like where they are in their business, right?
Yeah.
I always advise early stage founders to own as much of their business as possible, as you said earlier, right? And in order to maintain that, you have to be, the word is bootstrapped, right? Like you have to have that bootstrap mindset. And I was talking to a founder recently and she said, you know, we know how much money we have available to us. Mm-hmm. And based on that amount of money, I know how much I need to spend or I like can spend in a month and how minimal I want to keep my burn, right? Mm-hmm. My burn rate, meaning just how much money I'm going to lose essentially every month.
Yeah.
And then she makes her decisions based on, you know, this marketing or promotion or this sales event or whatever it is. She tiptoed into it to learn, what are the results of this? What isn't working? What is working? And then when it became repeatable, she put her foot on the gas, so to speak, right? Mm-hmm. But essentially, I think that what I'm saying is people try to grow too fast, even from day one. Mm-hmm. So I think balancing speed, right, with the amount of money that you have early on in your business is going to be key to not feeling the need or literally having the need to take on more debt and to go out and seek investment. For women, for people of color, we don't have as much access as, say, a white man, right, to traditional like funding and lending. That's just a reality.
It is.
But if you can take advantage of those things first, utilize them wisely, and be as patient as you can be with growth. I think one of the best things a founder can do is start slowly and just utilize data. Uh-huh. Gather data, utilize data, and make decisions based on it so that when they do start spending, they can really predict the outcomes like with a lot of certainty, really,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that you're right about when you take on funding or an investor, there is an expectation. Very few people invest in your business without the expectation of making money.
Yes.
That is why you invest in something. So in order for an investor to make money, your business needs to grow, right? And there are so many like VC funds, you talk about like SKU and Austin, right? These organizations where they're like, we help brands grow that want to exit. And like, that's the goal. Because guess what? That's how the investors make money.
Yeah.
So I think the other thing to do is like, in this vein, is to know what kind of business you want to be before you take
going
on that
back
funding.
To that. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Going back to that long-term strategy.
Yeah. Yep. And then finding, if you do need investment, find someone who understands and who's on board with the kind of business you are trying to build. There are people out there who want to invest in profitable companies that don't need to look big and giant and have a massive exit. Right.
But it's
a certain understanding of what those numbers are going to look like and, you know, what the business will look like.
Like that amazing granola founder on your podcast.
Hudson Henry. Her name is Hope. Yeah. Hope Lawrence.
Can you just like quickly explain her situation and like her, because I love her story.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, Hope created a granola brand that sold really well. She did local, like
super
sales
regional.
To wholesales. Yep. So she stayed really regional. She did D2C sales. And she grew the business to $1 million in revenue, annual revenue, and then sold it. But she sold it to a company that specialized in nuts and granola. And like dried fruit. So it wasn't a big conglomerate. She got a decent payday for herself that she was very happy with. And she was able to like leave a legacy because that brand still continues under like the original name and it's in good care. And a lot of her customers are still buying that product. And her story, if you listen to it, is just like controlled growth, not trying to grow too crazy. She had a team of like almost all part-time people, you know, kids in college and stuff like that. She built it out of the basement of her home, which like was a former bed and breakfast.
Yeah.
This is a really like very sweet story. And not everyone like is going to want to run their business forever. Like all good things must come to an end. But I love that they were profitable from, I think it was month number 6.
Yeah.
Right. They grew according to how they could grow with the funds that they had. They never took any outside funding. They had very little investment of their own early in the business. So it can be done, which is really exciting. And then you can sell to a mission aligned company.
I think she said she started with like $2,000, if I recall.
Like somewhere between like 2 and 6 is in my head.
Yeah, like 2 or 4, or maybe it was 8. I'm not sure. It's under $10,000, which is very impressive.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And she like got her whole family involved. And I think that's such a great example of a very successful exit that's
modest. And sure, she didn't have hundreds of millions of dollars or tens of millions of dollars of payday, yeah. but she still had a nice payday.
And she owned all of it. It was all hers, right? Like, I often wonder, like you said with your story, like how much of a business does the original founder still have, you know, and sure, you're getting, you know, a big payday, but like after you spread it all around and after you recoup the expenses that maybe you invested, like I'm always so curious in some sales, like what the founder truly ends up with.
I wanted to ask you, what did you think of the Poppy acquisition?
I'm dying to know the specific details about what I just mentioned.
Same
for that.
I know. How do we get that information?
I don't know. We're trying to do a case study on it for the podcast. And so, but yeah. It's like, I don't want to make any assumptions. You know what I mean? But yeah, I'm extremely curious about how that actually turned out for the founders.
Right. She definitely had a nice payday, her and her husband. But you're like, how big was
it? Compared to the sale amount, right? Like, mm-hmm. yeah.
What did that actually look like? And that's also just like a once in a million, you know what I mean? The odds of something like that happening.
Well, I think that's such a good point too, right? It's like, we know that corporate food is not innovating, right? And this is getting off topic. I know, I'm sorry, but like they're not innovating. The brands that we meet, the founders that we meet, that we talk to, you guys are the ones that are innovating, creating new product, really understand the needs of people. And one of you may, you know what I mean, hit it and grow and get an exit to a corporation. I'm going to just say it. I don't want that to be the goal for most people.
Yeah.
Because the other part of my background is that I come from local sustainable food.
Yeah.
And it is so scary to me for 10 corporations, 10 conglomerates to own our entire food system.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's not right.
Yeah. No. And I mean, we're even seeing it on like I'll call it a smaller scale now with David, right? The news of David like purchasing the entire supply chain. Mm-hmm. Like for his product and not making it available, you know, to others who may have been using it. Like, this is a dangerous position to get into. It's one of the reasons I'm so passionate about regional food and regional businesses.
Do you have a CPG product that needs to get to shelf and you're just tired of figuring it out alone? This is for you. I made Launch Lab for you. It's a 10-week accelerator built on my proven It's All Happening launch formula, the same system behind 30-plus successful launches and 50 million in sales. It's an operator-led, hands-on guidance with real expert connections, weekly live sessions, and a supportive community. I bring in amazing contributors who are experts in their field to teach workshops within the Launch Lab cohort. Jessica Lang said, I wish I found Danielle when I first started. Her playbook would have saved me so much time and money. The next Done With Me cohort isn't until 2026, and the cart closes on August 24th. If you're ready to join the 15% who survive, enroll now. You can learn more on my website at itsallhappeningagency.co. I should have asked you this at the beginning, and I'm sorry. Can you just give us a little bit about your background? I just love your background, like, and how you kind of got into this.
Yeah. Well, I got into food because I had really bad acne. And the only way that my cystic acne was cured after, like, all the heaviest drugs was food and changing my diet. I became obsessed once my skin cleared up with, like, where food comes from and what I'm eating and what goes into processed food and who owns our food system and all of these things. And so then I just jumped into volunteering at farmers markets. I was working at cooking schools. I had a corporate job on the East Coast. I would work from 6 to 2 and then I would go work at a cooking school, like literally doing dishes just so I had access to understand how they were sourcing and stuff. And I eventually co-founded a business called The Produce Project with a partner, and we sourced the best produce, meats, dairy, seafood from all around California and brought it to a community of people, growing people for 2 years. But we weren't making any money because we were building a business like a big grocery store. And I'm so grateful for that time, for that experience, and for that financial failure, because it informed like the next steps in my career and where I am now. And what I identified after that, and while I was working for a really great catering company, who sourced all like domestic, regional, local, sustainable, was that there's no shortage of desire for good food, for locally produced, like locally made food. But the financials are what hold the businesses back. And I was seeing amazing like butcher shops and food delivery and grocery stores just closing.
Left and right. Yeah.
Yeah. Because they just couldn't make the financials work. And I was like, we have to figure this out. Like, we can't not have these businesses. And there are so many things stacked against us when you talk about monopolies and Amazon and like local like law and stuff like that. But that background and working with farmers directly for years just really allowed me to see the importance of being close to the supply chain and being close to the people who make your food, whether it's in a jar or picked from the field. And I just really believe in supporting and building businesses like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So then, did you always have a degree in finance and you started to just like educate yourself on the operational side? Or did you decide to go back to school at a certain point?
Yeah, great question. So my, this is so funny. My undergrad is actually in marketing, which I never used. I had I ended up getting a second like degree, like bachelor's degree in something called operations information management, which essentially is data management in Excel spreadsheets. Like I loved these classes so much that I just took as many as I could and ended up getting a dual degree. I was not working in food yet when I went for my master's. And I knew that I wanted to have my own business someday. I had no idea what it would be. I had no idea what I would make and sell or like what kind of business it would be, but I knew I wanted to do it. And so when I went for my master's, I did, it's MBA, but it was entrepreneurship and finance. Right. Mm-hmm. It was honestly a little bit light on the finance because I wasn't really interested in like the stock market and any of that kind of stuff. Right. But I was interested in the finances of a business, how a P&L works, how a balance sheet works, right? All of that. And so that really went well together with this entrepreneurship like degree that they were offering. In hindsight, Danielle, which I think is so interesting, what I realized over the last couple of years is that they were not teaching me how to be an entrepreneur and create and like run a small business. Mm-hmm. What I was being taught was how to be entrepreneurial within a corporation.
Oh, interesting.
So I was getting like the finance education for like Tyson and Walmart and General Mills. We were looking at their financials. Sure. And then when we were like doing case studies on businesses, they were that big, right? Because A, you can't do case studies on private businesses because the data is not available.
Yep.
So they're teaching us on this corporate level. And so I think what happens a lot and what happened with me in particular is then you go and you try to replicate how you learned to build a business, how you understood finances and margins to work for a big business. And you try to replicate that on the small level. And it just doesn't work because General Mills, for example, has millions, if not billions of dollars on their balance sheet in debt. Right, that helps them produce their product so they can have a 30% gross profit margin and quote unquote be profitable on their P&L and have cash to kind of keep operating, right? Like that's their strategy. Small businesses don't. And so then that's where the conversation about margin, like it can't be 30% for a CPG brand.
No.
It can't be 50% for a small grocery store. It has to be higher because you simply will not have access to the kind of debt that you need in most cases to have a successful 30% margin business.
So what would you say to a founder that feels, I deal with this all the time, that feels the pressure of pricing their product in line with their competitors that have maybe been around for 10, sometimes 20 plus years?
Yeah.
What do you say to, what advice do you give to the founder that thinks that they have to be $3.99 on shelf because their competitor is $3.99 on shelf?
Yeah. I mean, because I'm a numbers person, I will illustrate as best I can what that means for their business, the investment that will take, etc. The other thing that I like to talk to them about. And I'm not a marketing person, as I just pointed out. And marketing strategy is not my strength. But I do understand that in addition to finance, you also have to have a strong brand strategy and brand identity, right? And if pricing at, say, $399 is going to be detrimental to your business financially, I advise that they find that they understand their customer better. Like, if your customer is truly not going to buy your product unless it's $399, we have to improve on your COGS. If you don't know, or you're assuming, or what happens a lot of times, and tell me if this happens with you too, is like when they're very early stage, like, I just can't charge more than that.
Yes, that's always the conversation. Yeah, the fear of low to no velocity, you know?
Yeah. So then it goes back to the conversation of who is your customer?
Yeah.
Where is your customer shopping? Is your customer shopping at Ralph's or Albertsons or Price Chopper or your Stop and Shop? Or are they shopping at Erewhon, Whole Foods? Like, mm-hmm. Are they shopping online? I think that it generally is like a lack of understanding of who their customer really truly is that makes people believe they have to be at a certain price point and match people on the shelf. Like, if your quality is so much better than those competitors, like, you shouldn't be priced the same.
Yeah.
Right? But you also shouldn't be showing up in stores where your customer isn't going and where customers who only want to pay $399 are going, right?
Yeah, exactly. I always like to explain it to sort of like help relieve that pressure and put it into perspective is like that company that you're sitting next to has been in market for 11 years, mm-hmm. right? They've achieved economies of scale that you're nowhere near achieving. And it's going to, you're years away from achieving their economies of scale that they have, right?
Well, not only that too, is like sometimes they'll be comparing themselves to another newer brand. And I always say you have no idea what their cash looks like. You have no idea if they are struggling or not. Like, you don't know. And I'm a really strong advocate for creating a financial strategy that works for your actual business, right? Because it's either that they have economies of scale, or it's that they have lots of debt that allows them to sell at that price.
Exactly. That
or
too.
It's that they're going out of business in a year because they can't sustain this low price on the shelf, you know?
Which could very well be possible. You know, brands come and go. So.
Yeah.
Sarah, thank you so much for having this conversation. I just love chatting with you.
I
could chat with you about this stuff for days. So where can people find you and all of your offers and everything?
For sure. Yeah. So pretty much my only social media right now is Instagram. That's at The Good Food CFO. And you can learn more about The Good Food CFO and our podcast at thegoodfoodcfo.com.
Yes, and highly recommend the podcast. Like I mentioned at the beginning, it really is. Like, if you're trying to educate yourself in this business, it's such a great resource. So thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for having me so much.
And I will see you soon.
Sounds good.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. It would mean so much to me if you like, subscribe, or share this episode with anyone who you think needs to hear. And if you're launching a brand and you need a CPG strategy advisor, visit my website to check out what we have to offer. I host free workshops from time to time. You have to sign up for emails to hear about those. And you can join Launch Lab, which is our group cohort that teaches you the four critical phases of launching your CPG brand and how to actually execute your launch quickly. We also do one-on-one advising. So if you book a profit plan session, I will assess your product profitability and recommend a package that works for you. You can book a call at itsallhappeningagency.co. You can email us at hi@itsallhappeningagency.co. And follow us on Instagram at It's All Happening Co. See you soon.